Should a woman over the age of 40 get regular mammograms? The question is deceptively simple. Today, we'll explore the history, science, and politics of the mammogram. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, I'll talk with Dr. Handel Reynolds. He is a breast radiologist in private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, and the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Later in the hour, Deborah Havel Corson is a clinical chief in the Department of Radiology at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. I'll talk with her about breast imaging technology available to Iowans, and she'll answer your questions. Talk of Iowa, weekday mornings at 10. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. If I asked you, what is the best way to detect breast cancer early when it's most treatable? You would probably say with a mammogram. But it turns out that the answer is not quite that simple. Today, we're going to look into the history and science of the mammogram. We're going to try to understand why it's ubiquitous and what it can and cannot do. Dr. Handel Reynolds is a radiologist in private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Dr. Reynolds, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's my pleasure.
Before the mammogram came along, it seems to me from reading your history that really the greatest innovation in treating breast cancer had been teaching women the proper technique for doing a breast self-exam.
Exactly. So starting about in the 1940s to 1950s, there was a major push by the American Cancer Society to teach women how to do breast self-examination. In fact, the technique was first developed by a radiologist who produced a short film that showed how women should examine their breasts. And this film was shown in cinemas and other large meeting halls. And this was the primary way that women were encouraged to find breast cancer early. Now, around about the early 1960s, some early research became available that showed that this new tool, mammography, could, in fact, find breast cancer when it could not be felt. And so this produced a great deal of excitement, particularly in the ranks of the American Cancer Society, and they launched into this mammography campaign that began in the early 1970s. Now, we should digress for just a minute, because the American Cancer Society was very involved in the promotion of the Pap smear, which became widely available in the 1950s. And that proved so successful in reducing the death rate from cervical and uterine cancer that when the mammogram became available and some of the early research showed its potential, that they, in fact, viewed this as possibly the Pap smear for breast cancer. And so it was with great anticipation and excitement that some of this early research in the 1960s and early 70s was received, and that kind of launched us on this trajectory where mammography was promoted as potentially a silver bullet in the fight against breast cancer.
Well, and there were some other things that made that moment when the mammogram was really introduced to the world in the early 1970s the politically perfect moment for mammography.
So there was a perfect storm of sorts, a convergence of several important events that took place in the late 1960s to early 1970s. We know that President Richard Nixon in the about 1971 or so signed the National Cancer Act, which set aside huge sums of money for cancer control efforts. And these huge sums of money would soon prove very important in the launch of this new tool, this mammography device, in 1973. At the same time, we had the women's health movement that had been percolating in the early to mid to late 60s, and we had the continuing effort of the American Cancer Society to promote early detection of cancers in general, but in particular cancers specific to women. So all of these forces saw a very useful convergence science in the early 70s as the early research on mammography became widely known and ensured that the launch of this tool would be successful, which it was for a few years, but then it quickly got embroiled in controversy.
Well, let's talk about what the techniques were back in the early 1970s for doing a mammogram. The title of your book is The Big Squeeze, which of course makes us think of modern tools for mammography.
Right.
But this was basically just a chest x-ray at the beginning,
right? Exactly, right. So there was really no squeeze involved early on because, early on we used a general purpose x-ray machine to perform this mammography test. It wasn't until, later in the 1970s that dedicated machines built just to perform mammography with a compression paddle, as we know today, became available. In fact, even into the mid-1980s, there were many facilities that were still using general-purpose X-ray equipment to perform mammography. So there has been a real evolution in this technology from, the general-purpose X-ray equipment to the dedicated equipment to digital mammography, which was rolled out about 12 years ago, to now what we have, this 3D mammography, which is the next step in the evolution of the technology.
When the mammogram was introduced, really in 1973, there was, as you mentioned, all of this money just sort of sitting there, ready to be rolled into some huge cancer prevention or cancer suppression treatment. And so the mammogram came across at just the right moment monetarily.
Right.
What was the research saying at that point about its efficacy?
Right. So in 1973, the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute launched a joint program known as the Breast Cancer Detection Demonstration Project. 280,000 women eventually were recruited to undergo routine annual screening with mammography and physical examination for 5 years. When they did this program, they opened it up to women as young as 35 years old. At that time, the only research that showed any benefit for women undergoing screening mammography was a study that was done in New York in the early 1960s, and it showed a benefit for women over 50. It showed no benefit for women under 50, partly because there weren't that many women in that age demographic. But the fact is, this was a demonstration program, not a research study, but it was opened up to women as young as 35 when at that time there was no scientific evidence that there would be any benefit. It is clear from my own research that the folks who ran this project at the time really felt that mammography would be helpful to these younger women, even though there was no real scientific evidence for it.
Well, and one of the people involved in that research, Dr. Philip Strax, had lost his wife at a young age.
Correct.
39,
at a very young age, at about 35 or so, and he was a very important participant in running this program. And so the program started in 1973, but it wasn't very long before the controversy erupted. So in 1976, there was a huge controversy that, in fact, was incited by a scientist at the National Cancer Institute, a Dr. John Baylor, who was a statistician, who started to raise a concern about the amount of radiation involved with mammography, specifically for these younger women. And so we had our first major controversy about screening mammography in women under the age of 50 3 years after mammography started. And this same controversy has erupted multiple times, up until the most recent eruption that we're all familiar with in 2009 with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So this has been the underlying perennial debate in mammography almost since the beginning.
Talking about Dr. Philip Strax and his concern for younger women, wanting to involve younger women in regular mammogram screenings, I think that there's a strong parallel to his personal feelings to many of the difficult politics of mammography today. And so I want to jump into talking about the movement for breast cancer awareness. And you actually tie this movement to the movement for AIDS awareness and AIDS prevention.
Yes. So, of course, the AIDS epidemic started in the early 1980s. And for a long period of time, for many years, there was general indifference on the part of the our government in terms of this developing epidemic, this catastrophe, if you will. And it wasn't until, you know, the late 1980s that AIDS victims and members of the gay community finally decided that they'd had enough. And this history is well documented in Randy Schultz's book and the band Played On, but they took to the streets in the late 1980s and demanded that our government do something to stop this horrible epidemic that was sweeping the country and, in fact, the world. And they managed to score some significant victories at that time. So the first standalone AIDS research bill was signed again in the late 1980s, and AIDS activists won a seat at the table in the halls of research at the NIH and so forth. Now, as this was playing out in the late 1980s, the American Cancer Society had announced that the lifetime risk of an American woman developing breast cancer had gone from 1 in 13 to 1 in 10. And in 1991, they changed that to 1 in 9. And so breast cancer all of a sudden took on an epidemic narrative of its own. At around the same time, in 1987, Nancy Reagan, former First Lady, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so all of these events pushed this epidemic narrative of breast cancer, and breast cancer patients and women in general learned from AIDS activists how to take to the streets, basically, how to demand more funding, how to demand more attention to this disease, and also scored significant legislative victories in terms of additional funding for breast cancer research and, for the first time, ensuring insurance coverage for screening mammography.
As this awareness was raised, there were also misconceptions that were widely accepted among the American public and really still are about the prevalence of breast cancer.
Yes. Yeah, so, for example, this lifetime risk statistic, currently 1 in 8 at the time, 1 in 10, 1 in 9, that statistic was promoted essentially ad nauseum, and it was promoted with no context. There was no discussion of the fact that this was a lifetime risk and that, you know, women were much more likely to die of many other conditions. There was also no discussion of the fact that there was no real epidemic of breast cancer per se, but screening itself had increased the rates of breast cancer such that, you know, we're seeing many more cases than before screening. So there was no true epidemic, but this epidemic narrative, this sense of, you know, a pervasive epidemic was very helpful in breast cancer activists getting the attention that the disease deserved, and also putting mammography on, you know, very secure footing for the future. So, you know, mammography ended up being both the cause and the solution,
right,
in this situation.
I'm talking with Dr. Handel Reynolds. He's a radiologist in private practice in Georgia. He's also the author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Deborah Havel Corson. She's supervisor of the Breast Imaging Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Right now, my guest is Dr. Handel Reynolds. He's author of The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. And Dr. Reynolds, before the break, we were talking about this epidemic narrative about breast cancer in the United States. And of course, we know now that because of more effective screening, we found out about a lot more cases of breast cancer than we ever would have found out about before. That saved a lot of people's lives. But you say we've also been finding cases of breast cancer that would not have needed to be treated?
Right. So as with screening for any cancer, there is the possibility that some of the cancers that are found at screening would not have become clinically evident in the person's lifetime absent screening. And this phenomenon is known as overdiagnosis. Now, we don't know precisely what the magnitude of this problem is, but there are several studies that have shown that up to a third of cancers that are found at routine mammographic screening could represent overdiagnosis. Now, in the book, I talk specifically about one type of breast cancer, and let me take a minute to explain that. There is a particular stage of breast cancer known as DCIS, or stage zero breast cancer, and this is where the cancer cells are completely confined to the milk duct. There is no lump, there's no pain, there are really no symptoms. So prior to mammography, this constituted about 1 or 2% of the total breast cancer burden. In the era of mammography now, today, DCIS constitutes up to 25% of all breast cancers. And so you ask yourself, why? And the reason for that is very simple. Mammography is essentially tailor-made to find DCIS because it shows up on a mammogram as little white specks, little crystals of calcium, little crystals of almost salt, and they're very easy to find. So we find a lot of this DCIS. Now, you may think, well, that's great. We're finding very, very early breast cancer. The problem is we know that the majority of DCIS lesions, if left alone, would never progress to the more significant form of cancer known as invasive cancer. And DCIS that does not progress is non-lethal. It cannot kill. So probably no more than a third to a half of DCIS cases, if left alone, would progress. So that means that potentially a large fraction of patients who are diagnosed with DCIS every year, up to about 50 or 60,000 women, represent overdiagnosis. Problem is, we can't tell which ones would and which ones would not.
Okay,
progress.
Lumps is found, the doctor cannot tell whether this
exactly.
is going to become invasive cancer or
that
whether it
correct.
Would just remain there.
You're absolutely right. There's no way to tell. So all women undergo treatment, whether it's a lumpectomy with radiation, whether it's a mastectomy. Some women, you know, up to 5% of women today are choosing to have both breasts removed for a single DCIS lesion. In fact, this is the kind of cancer that Nancy Reagan had. She had a small DCIS lesion that was detected on a mammogram. So it's a very, very common problem. And again, I don't want to necessarily say that the risk of an overdiagnosis is a reason why a woman should not have a mammogram. My point in writing this book is to foster informed decision-making. So for the past 20 or 30 years, we've used the approach of what I call the just-do-it approach. Mammography is good for you, just do it. We have highlighted the benefits, and we have very rarely discussed the potential risks or harms. And that's great if your goal is simply to increase utilization. And that has happened. You know, large proportions of women undergo regular mammography. But if the goal is to foster patient understanding, patient education, then you really do need to have a wider discussion. And so I hope my book will inform and educate and ultimately empower women as they, contemplate this very important decision.
Well, you know, when you talk about these detections of this kind of cancer, and the fact that some of these cancers are being treated and they wouldn't need to be treated, I would rather undergo cancer treatment, as incredibly as unpleasant as that must be, than die. And I'm sure that many other women are listening to that and saying, well, you know, that's too bad that people are getting treated for cancers that don't need to be treated, but I don't want to die either.
And that's fine. That's a perfectly legitimate conclusion from this information. But what I am saying is that we haven't put this information in front of the public. We have not discussed this issue. It is an issue that needs to be discussed. I don't really believe that our approach, where we only talk about the benefit, does modern women any service. I really think it does them a disservice. So I'm perfectly happy if women choose that approach. Look, I'm a breast radiologist, so I'm not opposed to screening. This is what I do every day. This is what I've done for over two decades. But what I am saying is that what I hope is that women will be able to have an open and full discussion with their healthcare provider regarding the risks and benefits of screening. And if a patient chooses to begin screening at 40, great. If she chooses to begin at 50, great. And if, after hearing all the risks and benefits, she chooses not to be screened, that's fine. But I really believe that patients deserve all the information so they can make an informed choice.
Well, and my response to just thinking about how this might affect me personally, I think that gets to some of the emotionally charged rhetoric that we get with the breast cancer awareness movement. That, you know, there are many people out there that say if it can save just one life, we need to be doing it.
Yes, And, you know, for example, you know, one of the other risks of screening is what we call false positives or false alarms, where women, after having a screening mammogram, are recalled for additional workup, like additional mammograms, ultrasound, or even a biopsy, and no cancer is found. Now, this is a major risk of screening, yet there's a high degree of tolerance for this problem. So in multiple surveys, we find that women express a great deal of anxiety and stress at the time of being recalled, but well over 90% of them go on to continue having routine mammography every year. So it was just a little bump in the road. And in fact, many surveys have shown that patients in general would tolerate hundreds of false positives if it might find one cancer. And so that's fine. Patients need the information, but as healthcare providers, we also need to be honest and forthright, because as patients are recalled, there is additional radiation that is often involved in these additional workups. And so there, you know, there is no free lunch. And so I really think that we need to give patients all the information, and I'm happy, you know, with whatever decision an individual woman makes after being fully informed.
When a woman has what is called dense breast tissue, it is far more difficult to find a lump with mammography. Explain that to me.
Yes, of course. I'd be happy to. So when you look at a mammogram, of course, a mammogram is a black and white image. And so you may see a lot of white tissue, which is what we call dense tissue. Or you may see a lot of gray or dark tissue, which is fatty tissue. Or you may see sort of an even mix of the two. Now, typically, younger women have dense breasts, very white breasts, whereas older women have more fatty breasts, sort of a darker color on the mammogram. The problem is that breast cancer shows up as a white object on a mammogram. So if you can imagine putting a white object in a white background, it becomes very difficult to perceive. So women with dense breast tissue suffer a double whammy. There are two problems. One is that the cancer is much harder to detect. And number two, they are, in fact, at higher risk of developing cancer. So it's a true double whammy. Now, as your audience probably has heard, over the past several years, there has been a movement across the country to inform women of this problem or this situation at the time of mammography. So currently, the states of Connecticut, Texas, Virginia, and most recently New York have passed laws where mammography facilities must notify patients after a mammogram if they have dense breasts. And if they do have dense breasts, they need to be told that they might benefit from other screening, such as screening with ultrasound or MRI. So this is a problem that we are finally coming to grips with. We have not really discussed it much over the years, but we are finally coming to grips with it. But here's what a woman should understand if she is contemplating undergoing these multi-layered screening protocols. So for example, 1,000 women who have had a normal mammogram, so you go in, you have your mammogram, it's read as normal. 1,000 such women, if they undergo screening with ultrasound right after that, we will find about 4 or 5 additional cancers that obviously we didn't know existed because we just gave all these women normal reports. To find those 4 or 5 additional cancers, we would recommend biopsies in 40 to 50 women. So yes, we can find additional cancers in women with dense breasts after doing an ultrasound, but it comes at a cost because the ultrasound will show lots and lots of other things that we will recommend a biopsy for, most of which, 90% of which, will not turn out to be cancer. So again, there's no free lunch. Yes, we can find more cancers, but at the expense of a lot of false positives or false alarms.
Are there other screening techniques that are more effective?
Well, you know, the other technique that your audience may have heard of course, is the MRI. And screening with MRI is currently recommended for women who are at exceptionally high risk, patients who are gene positive, BRCA positive. Screening with MRI is very expensive. It's a very expensive test, and it does involve getting an injection in your arm. And yes, it's very sensitive, so it will pick up most cancers, but it is also it does suffer from false positives as well. So there will be false alarms on MRI. So
plus, it's even more unpleasant than having your breast squeezed between two plates, right?
Well,
for a lot of people, at least.
I guess, But you know, you raise an important point, the discomfort of mammography. In my 21 years, I'm just repeatedly struck by the wide variability in the discomfort that patients report from mammography. I've certainly met numerous patients who say, oh, it's nothing, it's a piece of cake. And I've also met women who have told me that mammography is more painful than childbirth. So, you know, there is a huge spectrum in the response that women have to the compression with mammography. It runs the full gamut. So, yeah, an MRI, you know, there's no compression involved, but, yes, you do have to get stuck in your vein, you know, and an IV put in and so forth.
Do you think that our reliance on mammograms and really a general public perception that mammograms are this silver bullet for preventing or at least detecting breast cancer very early, do you think that that reliance and the investment in mammograms, do you think that that has prevented us from looking for other better screening tools?
Well, I think I should make it clear that I certainly do believe that mammography screening has played a role in the decrease in breast cancer deaths that we've seen over the past two decades. There's been about a 30% decrease in the death rate from breast cancer in this country. And probably about half of that improvement is due to mammography screening. The other half is probably due to improved treatment protocols. And, you know, to address your question specifically, I don't know necessarily if we've looked very, very hard or whether our, you know, reliance on mammography has given us a sense of complacency on this issue. But we've certainly seen improving mammography technology over the years. So, yes, we've kind of put all our eggs in the mammography basket, but at the same time, we've worked on making the mammogram a better and better tool. And, you know, as I mentioned very briefly earlier, we now have the 3D mammogram, otherwise known as tomosynthesis, that gives a pretty detailed look, even in dense breast tissue, that may address some of the downsides of mammography that we have talked about so far.
When someone comes to you as a radiologist, clearly that they've already made certain decisions about what kind of screening procedures they will use. But if you had an opportunity to talk to women at age 40 who were trying to decide whether they should start getting regular mammograms or not, what would you say?
Well, I would try to have a full and open discussion with that patient. So, for example, I would tell a 40-year-old woman that her likelihood of dying of breast cancer over the next 10 years without screening is about 0.35%, and with screening it's 0.3%. So there is a slight risk of dying of breast cancer in her 40s. It's a slight risk. We have to kind of keep it in perspective. And you can decrease that risk with screening. So that's a given. The benefits of screening exist for women in their 40s as well as 50s, 60s, and so forth. The magnitude of that benefit, however, is smaller for premenopausal women, women in their 40s, than it is for older women or postmenopausal women. I would also explain to that woman that she would likely possibly suffer some of the downsides of screening, for example, the false alarms or the false positives. So a woman who starts screening at age 40 and is screened annually for 10 years has a greater than 50% risk of experiencing a false positive mammogram. And again, as we've discussed previously, that does cause some stress, but no long-term detriment as far as, you know, continued mammography. I would explain about overdiagnosis, about DCIS, and answer her questions and basically support whatever decision she chose to make. And that is the approach that I favor, informed decision making, as opposed to basically looking at this patient and saying, well, I think you should have a mammogram, therefore, you know, just do it.
Do you think that we each need to take a look at our risk factors, such as family history,
yes,
such as diet, such
weight
as well?
Yeah. Clearly, and everything we've discussed so far really should be understood to apply to women at average risk. Whole different category are women who are at particularly high risk, like women who are BRCA positive. They need to undergo multi-layered screening. So, for example, they are advised to undergo mammography, pardon me, and MRI annually because that will significantly increase the likelihood of finding their cancers early because they are at really, really high risk of developing breast cancer. Women who are not BRCA positive but who have multiple family members with breast cancer, for example, a woman whose mother was diagnosed with breast cancer in her early 40s, she may want to consider beginning her routine mammography in her mid-30s. So yes, you do have to look at your own risk profile, and if you are at elevated risk, you may want to be more aggressive in your screening. You may want to talk to your doctor about whether you should add other layers of screening to mammography. If you're dense-breasted and you have multiple risk factors, should you also have an ultrasound for screening? Recognizing that you may find a cancer that was missed on the mammogram, recognize also that you may suffer multiple unnecessary biopsies and never find any cancer. So these are all considerations that I think should be part of this open discussion that I hope women will have with their physicians.
Dr. Handel Reynolds, thank you so much.
Charity, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate being on your show.
Dr. Handel Reynolds, the author of The Big Squeeze, a social and political history of the controversial mammogram. We've been talking about mammography this hour, and in just a moment, I'll be talking to Deborah Havel Corson. She is the supervisor of the breast imaging department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're going to talk about the different kinds of technology available in that clinic and to women and doctors in Iowa for screening for breast cancer. We also want to answer your questions. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we've been talking about the history of the mammogram, an imperfect tool used to screen for breast cancer, an imperfect tool that has saved many lives. My guest now, Deborah Havel Corson, makes use of this tool and others to find breast cancer. She is the supervisor of the breast imaging department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Hello, Deb.
Hi, Charity. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for asking me.
And we are going to talk about the different tools available to doctors and women in Iowa to find breast cancer. We also want to give you a chance to ask your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Remember, though, Deb cannot give you medical advice. That's something you need to talk to your doctor about, but you're welcome to answer or ask any questions that you have. Deb, let's talk about some of the different kinds of tools that you have at your disposal when women come into the clinic. And the first one I want to talk about is digital mammography. Mm-hmm. How is that different from the traditional kind of mammography that we've been talking about today?
The mammogram itself is the same. We still use the compression just like we would use on a film screen, the first one that they've ever developed. What we're doing now is taking that image now and putting it into a digital world. So we're able to manipulate the image for different factors of the breast. And the biggest thing that digital does is that it's able to penetrate denser tissue in the breast so we can see through it a lot better than the film screen that we used to use.
Explain that a little bit further to me. So you have basically the same image?
It's the same images, yes, same images. It's just produced a different way. Instead of using a film that we have to process, you know, like a hard copy film, that's all done on a computer now. And then you're able to look at it and manipulate it, like increase the like the gray tones in it or do that kind of thing. So you're able to just be able to do more with the mammogram itself.
Okay, so you can look at it in different ways.
Right.
You
window
can manipulate
level it.
The image.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's a really nice feature for, especially when women that have denser breast tissue. A fatty breast, it doesn't do any different. The film screen way and the digital way, they're just comparable. You know, it's the people that have the denser fibrous tissue in the breast.
And we talked about that a little bit with Dr. Reynolds mm-hmm. a moment ago, but describe the difference between someone who has what you're talking about, fatty breast tissue as opposed to dense breast
right.
tissue.
A lot of women, they come in and say, oh, I have really dense tissue. But they're just fatty. I mean, you can't tell from the outside, you know, of what the breast looks like. Fatty tissue just shows up gray on the film, just one color all the way across. dense tissue shows up white, gray, black, all different colors in the black and gray scale. And really dense tissue is hard to penetrate through because it's thicker, you know, than the fat tissue. So it's a little bit harder to see, and those are the people usually we would have to call back to have additional images, because we use a smaller paddle and just concentrate over that area to try to spread it out a little bit better.
And there's no way to know if you have dense breast tissue or fatty breast tissue before you get a mammogram?
No, not really. Now, they have talked, and the state of Iowa doesn't do it yet, but they have talked about when you, after you have your mammogram, you are, and some states, like I say, do this, but you are supposed to, in your letter that you get from the radiologist, it was supposed to say, do you have fatty breasts or dense breasts in it? So then, as a patient, you will know what your breast tissue is like.
You also use breast ultrasounds, yes. And again, we were talking about that technology mm-hmm. with Dr. Reynolds, mm-hmm. which really does give you a better look inside the breast?
Breast ultrasounds are for somebody who has a palpable lump, and a lot of times there's really nothing there, but we can see that on an ultrasound. If it's just normal breast tissue that they're feeling, you know, and usually it the mammogram, you know, but we do that here at the university. Anybody that has a palpable lump, we always take a second look with an ultrasound. Now, another thing that happens in the breast, and I think this is where people get confused at, is that there's called calcifications. And calcifications are not seen on an ultrasound. They are pinpoint, like if you would take a pencil and just dot, they're so small that the only way you can see those is with a mammogram. And then we do special pictures as a second look, what are called magnification, and that is able to then make them bigger so we can characterize them. Is this something worrisome looking, or is this something that it looks benign? So it's and then a lot of times we follow them up and do different things. But ultrasound basically is for somebody with a palpable lump, or they find something on a mammogram that we do a MR, but calcifications we don't. So
when you talk about a palpable lump, that's something, uh-huh. a lump that you can feel,
right?
Right. So when you look at a lump with the ultrasound, is mm-hmm. this a situation where you might be actually avoiding doing a biopsy?
Yes, you can, because an ultrasound, if it looks totally cystic, we don't have to do a biopsy on that. There's no reason for that. If it looks something that's worrisome, yes, they'll do a biopsy. And then there's a gray period in between, and it's called a BI-RADS 3. There's between, we have 0 through 6, what we call BI-RADS, meaning that is a universal number that is used worldwide. And so if you would take your mammogram to China, they should be able to say, oh, this is what you had before. You know, everybody knows these BI-RADS. But a BI-RADS 3 is meaning that you need to come back in 6 months to have another look at it. Make sure it hasn't grown. Make sure it hasn't changed. And those are kind of like they're 98% sure that that's not something worrisome that needs a biopsy, but they just want to take a quicker look than a whole year. So. And we have a lot of women that do that, and it's a little bit nerve-wracking. Some women don't want to wait, and in that case, we'll go ahead and do a biopsy for that person. But, you know, a lot of people don't want a biopsy, so they'll wait for do that. So,
with the breast ultrasound mm-hmm. technology, do you find that a lot of things show up that wouldn't have been seen with the mammogram and sometimes mm-hmm. do create false alarm?
Not necessarily. No. I think that right now, with the stuff that we use right now, the digital, most of the time, if they see something, there's usually something there. Once in a great while, I do breast ultrasound also, and once in a great while, yes, we will find something, but it's few and far between now. The mammogram and the ultrasound, you know, if they see something on that, usually it's on the ultrasound. If they don't see it, but a palpable, they're usually, most of the times, they're not something there. So, it just gives the patient, I think, a better, what do I say, like a, leave them at ease a little bit more if they have both modalities.
Sure, sure. Well, and some women also get MRIs, magnetic resonance
right.
imaging. What can you see with an MRI that you can't see in the other ways?
The MRI is only used for usually staging if somebody has been diagnosed for a breast cancer. And they want to make sure that there's nothing else in that breast. Just want to make sure. And most of the times there's not. Once in a while, but the MRI will show a lot of false positives. And so then what will happen is they'll come back for an ultrasound. I'll ultrasound them, and usually you don't find anything. But it's just, but it's good. And then women who have, like, they're positive for the gene, they do them every year as, like, a preventive thing, you know, too, because usually they're women that have very dense breasts, and once in a while we get in the same issue with them, false positives. But, you know, for them it's very essential to have all the testing done because they are very high at risk.
And with the MRI, do you also use that technology for testing women who have had and recovered from breast cancer? Is that something to do follow-ups with?
It depends, I think, a lot on what type of cancer it was. Or then certain cancers have more tendency to do both. But we don't see that very often here because we don't do MRI in this clinic. The MRI department does it. So a lot of those women we don't see who goes down there, you know, and everything. So, but mainly it's done for staging after a diagnosis of cancer and follow-up for somebody who has a gene for breast cancer. So
we were talking a few minutes ago again with Dr. Reynolds, who mm-hmm. wrote the book The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he was saying was that he wants his patients to have all of the information so they can make an informed
sure.
decision
sure.
on their own. The idea of making an informed decision is a little bit frightening because, of course, we are not doctors.
Yeah, no.
We don't know.
It is. I mean, and, you know, the thing I'm going to also kind of, as of maybe mid-October, here at the University of Iowa, and also we're opening up a clinic to make it more easier for our patients to get to for mammography and stuff, we're going to have tomosynthesis. And tomosynthesis is actually, it's the same squeeze that a mammogram normally does. But what it does is it comes down, takes the image just like you do now. In the same squeeze, it flips over 7 degrees to the left, and then it takes about 11, 15 pictures, and then it lets the person up. And they do this all in 3 seconds. But what that does is it's like if you want to see a CT, it takes slices of the breast. So the radiologists then are able to scan through the whole breast. And our hope is, and that's the hope of tomosynthesis, is that it's going to cut down on biopsies and we'll be able to see things perfectly good in this technology. And we might not have to do an ultrasound because we can go right through that area and we can say, oh, no, that's a cyst, or oh, no, that's something worrisome. So, but we're in the process of getting FDA approval and everything for this, and we hope to get it up by the middle of October.
All right. And tomosynthesis, it is an X-ray technology.
Yes, it is.
But it creates a three-dimensional image?
Well, it's not like you'll have the breast on the, you know, like you'll be able to see it in, you know, 3D or 4D. It's just when you go through it, slice through it, you're able just to see that little bit of a thickness of the breast tissue. I mean, it, like I said, it's hard to explain, but it's like taking the mammogram and then you'll go through the skin and then the next slice will be like 1 millimeter up further and then further and further. So you're able to see through the whole breast almost as a three dimension, almost, not quite, but, and then you'll be able to find anything small that's in that cancer could be in your breast.
That sounds like very exciting technology.
Yes, it is. It's very exciting, and we are all excited about this technology, and it's just something that we're as technologists, you know, as a, you know, hopefully it'll save back for people to have to be called back from having extra pictures, and that's saving stress on the patient, you know. The only thing that tomosynthesis doesn't do is if you have these calcifications, like I said that ultrasound doesn't take care of, you still have to come back and have the magnification views. I mean, it's more for masses than it is for the calcifications. So
okay. We have a number of callers on the line. Mara
okay.
is on the line from Des Moines. Hello, Mara.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I would like her opinion. I can just tell you I was a little concerned about what the doctor from Georgia said, because I'm a person with no family history. I am 57, but I'll be 58 this week, and I got diagnosed when I was 48. I was not overweight at all. In fact, I was more on the lean side, no family history. And my OB at the time said to me, well, I missed that one, and it was the mammogram that actually caught it. And I had gone from zero, I say, to 1.9 centimeters in a year. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered what her, I mean, I obviously follow things having to do with breast cancer.
Sure.
And so I wondered what her perception was of just the traditional old mammogram, because I have a daughter who's 20, and I'm very concerned, obviously. And like I said, no family history, no big traits at all. So it's very hard for me when I read articles about what you can do to take care of yourself and avoid your cancer risks.
And then
I get it, you know.
Yeah. We see that situation all the time. I bet only 20% of our patients who have breast cancer have family history. It's very small, very small. It's just that it's out there now, you know, it's affecting everybody, and that's why it's like 1 in 8 will get it. But I mean, for your daughter, what we recommend is if anybody, unless you want to go through the gene testing, but she doesn't have to worry about getting a mammogram. It's 10 years younger than when you were diagnosed. So you were diagnosed at what age again?
48.
48. So that means maybe she might start doing mammograms at 38. Normally we say 40. So it's usually 10 years. So like if a woman was diagnosed at 40, then her daughter should start getting mammograms at age 30.
Okay.
That's what we recommend. So to try to let your mind at ease a little bit, that's what like we would tell all of our patients, you know. But if she feels a lump or a bump, be sure to go in right away. We do mammograms between 30 and 35 if they have a lump or a bump. But we normally don't try to start till about 40. So,
and do you, I think that was the other thing. I didn't do self-exams beforehand. I had attempted, I said I had attempted them. But, you know, when you feel your own breast and it feels lumpy and bumpy to start with and you don't have, I'm kind of concerned about the training aspect of training women to do this, because until you actually feel what one feels like, the bad news, you don't have a good point of reference.
Right, and they have done a study. I don't know where it was done at, but this is what I tell my patients also, is that they did a study on, like, women who did self-breast exams and women who didn't do self-breast exams, and there was no correlation. There was nothing that said the people that did breast exam found a breast cancer sooner. A lot of the breast cancers are deep, and
them. Mine was deep.
Yes, and you don't feel it. So if women want to do it, that's totally fine. But if you don't want to do it, it doesn't make it that you're going to find something usually a little bit sooner.
Right. And so I think it's okay. Like, I promote to all my friends and family, do it. Get your mammogram.
Yeah,
I don't care what they say. Do it.
Yeah. No, we, you know, and there's a lot of things out there, like thermography and different things like that, that have not got any, it's not FDA approved and stuff, and they promote that, but it's not as good as the standby mammogram.
All right, Mara, thank you so much for your call. I'm glad you're healthy now. And Deb, we're out of time, but thank you for your time today.
No problem at all. That's great.
Deborah Havel-Corson is the supervisor of Breast Imaging Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. You can send us email anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Wildlife Day with Jim Pease. We'll talk about rabies, distemper, and other animal diseases that scare us. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.